I want to be a billionaire, and I mean that. I've always been afraid to say that. I don't just want to be known as the chess and slums guy or the charity guy. I want to make a lot of money, and I also want to have a lot of power.
Tunde is the founder of Chess and Slums Africa, a movement that began with borrow chess boards in Lagos and has since inspired a global wave of hope.
I grew up in Ikorodu, and my dad, you know, at the time was a downfall driver. You know, my mom was a petty trader, you know, at a coal market, and my parents were not educated. But one thing they wanted, we get the education that they did not get, right? Because my mom was a hustler. She used to be one of those Loma people that like sweep major roads, sold pure water, or shoddy on the bridge, and did all of this thing because she wanted us to have an education. So that sort of like defined my purpose at a very early age, that I was meant to be the child to save my family from poverty.
From the streets of Ikorodu to Times Square and the Guinness World Record, Tunde has turned a quiet game into a loud statement about possibility, dignity, and the untapped genius of African children. But behind the headlines is a story of deep personal transformation, from a boy raised in poverty to a man building classrooms without walls.
When you say you want to take chess to places of extreme poverty, people think you're a madman. Because you are indeed a madman. Yeah. Because what children in extreme poverty need is food, not chess. But I had a different understanding that we could take this thing that has always been perceived as an elite game and give it new meaning by using it as a way to define an intellectual identity for children.
In today's episode, we explore the emotional cost of carrying this mission, what drives him to keep going, and how he's navigating fame, failure, and the future with grace.
Fame is a curse, honestly. Everything gets thrown at you. The media, you know, everyone loves you. The moment you overstep, that could turn very easily, and you feel people's vitriol with the same level of intensity as the love that you had from them. So the first thing I had to do to shield myself was to not believe the hype.
Tunde, you've broken the Guinness World Record twice, but take us back. Who was Tunde before all the noise, before chess?
We have a lot of people who tune into this podcast. They may be in their car on the way to work. They may be listening to this as they're getting ready for the day. You know, just a really intimate time to connect to Afropolitan. And so I really want, for that person who clicks this episode and is interested in learning your story, what is the one thing you want to share with them about grit?
About grit?
Yes.
Thank you once again for having me, Chika Iche. And for the listeners, I like to pretend that every time I get to like share my story or share the details of like why I am what I do, that I'm also sort of like speaking to fellow dreamers like me who are a bit delusional about the things they believe in. So I think one thing is that I know to be true is the man who has like the tenacity to stay through all seasons would always emerge as the outlier. Mm. You know, and I've always been referred to as an outlier because I've taken something so unconventional and I've given it new meaning. So for the listeners, for the dreamers like me that don't yet know if they can also be outliers, you know, I'd say this, that I've met a lot of outliers and I've met a lot of people who have done pretty remarkable things. And the differentiator is an intelligence. Mm. Differentiator is always tenacity and grit, that staying power to stay with something that you believe in, that is your truth, until the world comes to believe it. So that is what I would say. Mm. Stay with something long enough, well enough, and not only will it become prestigious, but it also emerges an outlier. And what the outlier does is he takes the road less traveled and it blazes a new trail for others to follow.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Tunde, you've broken the Guinness World Record twice. But take us back. Who was Tunde before all the noise, before chess?
Before all the noise, before chess.
Yeah.
You know, interestingly, I was sharing some of my throwback pictures yesterday on Twitter.
Yeah.
People couldn't believe it because I think a lot of people came to the knowledge of who Tunde is from the world record. Like a lot of people, there are a lot of people that don't even have any previous context or like the work that I've done with Chess and Slums in the last 7 years. And there's some people that even think I live in New York and I'm this chess master guy that is always just breaking world records. But, you know, the real OGs before IG know that, long before any of this happened. And I'll maybe throw it back to 10 years ago was I was this very young, naive kid from Ikorodu who knew very little of the world, but had this one extraordinary skill that he could do better than most people in the world, right? But he also came to the understanding that that skill or that talent, like, could serve him. But then that would be such a selfish way to be ambitious, right? And at a really young age, he found a way to take that talent, that skill, and give it back to the world as a gift. Mm-hmm. And that has defined my entire journey, you know. And there's this beautiful quote by Rumi that says, as we walk, the road continues to appear, you know. So that boy started off with that thought in mind that he could use his talent mm-hmm. and give it back to the world as a gift. And that has defined the very essence of who I am, from, you know, doing chess and slums to doing the very crazy stuff like breaking the world record and really just finding a way to inspire people with my story and my journey and inspire a world where we can create more belonging for other people. So, yes, that is who I was, you know, small boy from Ikorodu with very big dreams that loved to play the piano, you know, and just was very curious about the world.
What did you witness or survive that shaped your obsession with purpose?
Yoruba people have the saying that on Okon Waja, it means one road doesn't lead to the market. There are multiple ways to go to the market or multiple entry points into the market. A lot of things, I believe, have contributed to my becoming. But what I would say is the earliest context is the connection to my own personal story. So I grew up in Ikorodu, and I was born in Lagos, in K2. And my dad, you know, at the time was a downfall driver. You know, my mom was a petty trader, you know, at a coal market. And my parents were not educated. But one thing they wanted, and one thing that, you know, my mom was so relentless about was that we get the education that they did not get, right? Because my mom was a hustler. She did everything. She used to be one of those Loma people that, like, sweep, you know, major roads. She sold pure water at Oshodi on the bridge and did all of these things because she wanted us to have an education, right? There was something that used to cause her so much pain. Whenever she went to, like, other people's house to, like, help them with, like, cleaning their house or washing their clothes, and she would see their own children. And she would say this in Yoruba as well. I'll translate it that. Pretty much means that I want you to be able to grow into an adult that can speak amongst his peers. You know, because she felt like she was denied that. She was brought from the village at a young age into, like, servitude. And all of the sacrifices for her was just something that she was completely immersed in just to ensure she could give us a future that she didn't have. So that sort of, like, defined, like, my purpose at a very early age, that I was meant to be the child to save my family from poverty. As a first child, as a first one, you know, my family had this huge expectation that they were willing to make all of this painful sacrifices so Tunde could become a doctor. You know, of course, it didn't pan out that way. But I guess it gave me a reason to understand life from a place of deep pain and also empathy for others, right? And all of this has sort of, like, informed who I am right now, right? Growing up from a small place and just giving me the privilege to fight for my place in the world, and now deciding to do the same thing for other children like me. I think that is the personal connection, you know, from my own beginning to where I'm now becoming.
And what was that pain? You know, you just spoke about it and you talked a lot about how you turned that pain into purpose. But what was actually the pain? And do you feel like you still deal with it?
It's a lot of things, you know. And I was saying this recently, that I hope if I come back to this life, that I hope life is kinder to me. You know, we like to talk about, like, a lot of, like, our trauma, childhood trauma that, like, forges us. And honestly, there's some positive to it because it helps you make it through to the other side, but also leaves a lot of painful scars as well. And those scars are always just there waiting to be triggered. You know, you would think, oh, you came out fine. You know, I think it's something I'm still learning to grapple with, but a particular one is when I was 9 months old. I felt ill, My mom doesn't remember all the details. It was probably measles or polio. She wasn't exactly sure. And because, you know, they're going to the hospital for people like us was a luxury. So it was always local herbs or some local nurse in the community that isn't a nurse, but everyone calls her nurse, you know. So called the person and she injected me wrongly. And that triggered a medical condition called a vascular necrosis, which is basically the death of like blood supply to bone tissue, you know. And I was still so young. So after some time, I got better. But then my mom saw that I'd stopped walking completely. Like as a child, I was always very active, you know, but I'd stopped walking completely. And she was alarmed. But then there was no money to go to the hospital. So it just, you know, lingered for a bit. And I think it was when, then after some time, I started walking again. So when I clocked 11, I started to feel a lot of like excruciating pain in my right leg. And this pain wasn't something that I could explain to others. And, you know, it made me start limping a bit on my right leg. And I just lived with the pain because there was nothing we could do about it. There was no money to go to the hospital or see a doctor. So it just became a part of my day-to-day, right? At some point, I'd become numb to it, you know, and that pain was something that made me a very like recluse kid. You know, I didn't like to like join other kids, you know, to do things. So I guess it was probably one of the reasons why I took such a passion to chess, because it was the one game that I could do in solitude, you know, because I was a very shy kid, you know, and because of the pain that I had, I always like avoided trying to do a lot of physical stuff. So that pain sort of like defined like a lot of like what I had to learn on my own, right? Spend a lot of time with myself and my thoughts, right? And I remember when I reached like an inflection point where I needed to decide if I was going to Jackman and leave the country or stay back and do this Chess and Slums project. I think the pain was one of the reasons that reminded me that, okay, see, I don't have a lot of years to be strong, you know. You know, I'd probably end up in a wheelchair. I mean, these were just silly thoughts I had that I was going to dedicate. I was 21 at the time. That I was going to dedicate the strongest years of my youth to fight for something in the world that I really wanted to do. And that was very defining. Without that pain, I mean, I've decided to just leave and my journey would have taken a much different trajectory, but I'm glad I did. So that is how that pain can be beauty, but in some other sense, it can also be absolute terror. Mm-hmm.
Mm. And what does that look like today with you dealing with the pain? Has it completely gone away or have you had to adjust to it?
I eventually had surgery 2 years ago. I had a hip replacement surgery. So that was one of the worst periods of my life, you know, because I couldn't walk for like 4 months. I was in a wheelchair, you know, I was using crutches. I was literally learning to walk again as a child, you know. And I remember then I was terribly depressed because it felt like the world had moved on. I was already gaining some momentum with the work, getting recognized. I'd been invited to Oxford. Then all of a sudden, everything just stood still. And yeah, I was at home. If I needed to go to the toilet, my mom had to carry me. You know, it was painful. But I think someone told me something then that helped me like reframe what that moment was and what I could do with that pain. It said, see, it's okay for you to be still now. Just let the world move on. Because one day you would move again and the world will stand still for you.
Yeah.
And it was such a beautiful thing to understand, right? That sometimes it's okay to just be and not constantly do. Because it was a time I needed to heal. I needed to spend a lot of time with myself, right? And when it was time for me to move again, when I eventually, you know, dropped the crutches, you know, the world stood still for me in all my moments and all the things I needed to do to inspire the world once more. Right. And that really just tells a very important lesson about understanding time and seasons. I mean, now the pain is gone. I'm still healing. You know, the surgery was a very complicated one. And the implant has a lifespan of like maybe 15 to 20 years if you're lucky. Then you have to do a revision surgery. Mm-hmm. And because I'm still so young, it means I probably have to do it like 2 or 3 times in my lifetime. So that is scary. But then the way I've tried to like make sense of it is, okay, I have 15 to 20 years to be strong. I use this iron, my cyborg hip. Yeah. Then I'm going to be unstoppable and do the best that I can with it.
Do you sometimes, and this is just more for my personal question, because I've had to live with some pain this year. Mm. And when that pain goes, is there a PTSD where you lived so long with the pain, but now the pain is no longer there? How do you navigate, like, your mind still thinks about the pain, but physically it might not be there as well. Is there still a little PTSD with that?
Like phantom pain.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Yeah. You know, and we all find a way to cope. Mm-hmm. And I guess for me, it's like the pain and the many years of like, of the damage it had done is something that you cannot change. You cannot take back. You know, surgery can fix things. Doctors can try, but there's also like a lot of like psychological damage that it has done over time. And I think that would always remain with you. And for me, like evidently, like there's a scar, mm-hmm. like there's literally like a long scar, you know, my right hip. But I guess, you know, that scar really is a reminder that healing is possible,
yeah.
right? In fact, any kind of scar, you know, whether the ones we can see or the ones that are like in here, is always a reminder that healing is possible. A scar is also proof of something that shouldn't be there, you know? So there are times when something happens that sort of like triggers it, or when I try to do something. I remember like before the surgery, you know, I couldn't like jump very high, right? Because there's always a risk of like breaking like the hip bone mm-hmm. completely. You know, now I can jump, but I still hold myself back. Nothing happens to the implant, you know? So it's always just still there. And it takes a lot of like work to like break through knowing that you have some more liberty to like exert yourself, but you're still extremely careful. So you don't do too much and go back to the status quo. So it's still always there.
So chess is often seen as a game of strategy, mm-hmm. but for you, it became a tool of transformation. How did that shift happen from player to movement builder?
So I did learn how to play chess in a barbershop. So after my primary school education, I had to drop out of school, you know, for 2 years because there was no money anymore. We only barely had enough to feed. You know, my dad's downfall had an accident, and so we just didn't have any income anymore. And my mom was still working as a cleaner, but she wasn't making enough. So I had to stop going to school so my younger brother could go to school because he was still in like primary one and he couldn't read and write. So in those years, I used to help my mom sometimes go to the market, you know, and some other days I would just pretend that I wasn't feeling too well, you know, so she would just leave me alone, you know. And on those days, I would go to this barbershop. They had a game center, and I watch other kids that should be in school, you know, but come there in their uniforms, you know, playing video games and gambling. I would just watch them wishing that I had the opportunity to go to school because I was a really curious kid. I really wanted to learn. And it was one of those days I saw a chessboard for the first time. You know, the barber was like in one corner, playing against himself and reading a book. And I was immediately fascinated by the way the pieces were carved. It was love at first sight for me. I'd never seen anything so beautifully designed. And it was the kind of thing that a child sees that would always want to ask questions like, why does this look like a donkey? What is this? Meanwhile, it's a knight, you know. And I pressed, but it wouldn't teach me. It would instead tell me to watch, you know. And I kept watching. I went back home myself. And I, because I was a very creative child, I got a cardboard. I, you know, drew out the checkered squares, and I got clay and I molded the pieces, and I taught my brother how to play. So that was how my journey of like learning chess started. I eventually went on to college on a scholarship. I represented my school, won multiple gold medals, you know, became a national master. And it wasn't really that chess changed my life as a player. It gave me an opportunity to leave Ikorodu for the first time, to see the world beyond those confines. And that gave me an opportunity to also go to college and scholarship. But then it didn't change my life financially, right? So there was a point where I gave up on it. There were not enough tournaments. I wanted to be a grandmaster, and that meant I had to travel to Europe. And I had to make the painful decision to just give up on those dreams and get a real job, you know, like my parents, you know, were so worried at the time. And that was when I found purpose. It was in the middle of like letting go of chess completely and trying to survive, that I stumbled upon like my purpose, right? And where that evolution happened was me understanding that this talents that I had, like me using it for my own personal glory, wasn't going to take me as far. But if I could take that and I could give it back to the children like me, then it would have so much more meaning behind it. So that was when I had the idea to start teaching chess in schools as a way to help children, you know, find a new way to understand their minds, right? To help them build an intellectual identity, build confidence through ability. And because chess is such like a cerebral game, like a child excelling at chess does wonders for their self-esteem. It did for me, you know. So that was the thought behind it. And I started doing it in schools until it eventually evolved to go into the slums and helping other children like me as well.
What's the emotional cost of reinvention when the world wants you to stay who you were?
Yeah, and actually, I think it's important to give more context because with this question, you know, I know we have a lot of private conversations. And so I want you to reflect on, you know, you've broken these Guinness World Records and you've built this amazing organization called Chess in Slums. You know, how do you go from that to being the brand? Like now you have to reinvent yourself of how you present and how you connect to different people in the world.
That's a very good question. And it's one that I'm still figuring out. Like I wouldn't say that I now have all the answers or have all the required like insights and understanding to make sense of what my life has become. You know, it started out very simply, right? I had a gift, I had a talent, and I wanted to share with other people, right? And which is how I believe our civilization has advanced, because men and women of great talent have found a way of using that, you know, to impact the world, whether it be at a product or a service, right? Everything that we surround us as being like, is a product of someone's thoughtfulness, right? Someone's talent, someone's ability to do something that the world now celebrates in some sense. So everything you see is a passion project. And which is why I sort of like thought about my own contribution, you know, with chess as my own like passion project for the world, right? And it started small. Nobody cared about it. Of course, when you say you want to take chess to places of extreme poverty, people think you're a madman because you are indeed a madman. Yeah. Because what children in extreme poverty need is food, right? Not chess. Chess is an elitist game. But I had like a different understanding that we could take this thing that has always been perceived as an elite game and give it new meaning, right? By using it as a way to define an intellectual identity for children. Because see, we talk about poverty and our only understanding of it is how maybe they say it's $2 daily. You know, that's a poverty line. You know, people living below $2, but that is not the full story. And we all know this, right? The full story is that people are completely removed from systems, right? And the ones that bear the full brunt of poverty, right, are the children. And what it does really is that poverty robs them of their identity before they have their own agency. So they become victims of both their parents' poverty, their environment, malnutrition, like all of these different factors culminate into like impacting that child so negatively that, you know, they no longer have a place to really function in society. Right. So chess for me was like this disruptive factor. And through 7 years, we've helped so many children. But then after my surgery, I had to start thinking about my life a bit differently, right? Because I felt like I'd given so many years of my life to service. I had completely neglected myself, my health, and even my own pursuits, right? I had sacrificed all of it on the altar of like, oh, helping the children, doing. And it was in those months that I couldn't walk, that I was learning to walk again, I realized that I didn't have any sort of personality outside the work that I did with the children, any sort of ambition, right, outside that. So that was when I started like recondition my mind to like also do something for myself, right? And sometimes it may be okay to be selfish, right? Because it helps you expand the depth of what you can draw from. You're not going to draw from an empty well, right? And that was when I started to play chess again. I went to Germany. The video of me playing 10 people went viral. I went to America for the first time. You know, I started traveling and, you know, all of it culminated into me breaking the world record and inspiring millions of people around the world. And that created a crisis of identity. And to answer your question, it put me into this terrible situation where I had become famous, you know, and it felt like I had now have the privilege to carry the weight of both ends of the spectrum, you know, being able to like teach the children in the slums and now dining with people that I used to regard as celebrities that have now become friends and colleagues. All of a sudden, everyone wanted to be my friend. You know, everyone wanted to invite me to this. People were inviting me to like conferences all around the world to speak and to do all of these things. And it just felt like all of a sudden I was ushered into this different life and I struggled. In fact, I made a lot of mistakes because the real challenge was trying to reconcile, you know, like my heart with my mind. Mm-hmm. My mind was, Tunde, man, you need to capitalize on this 15 mm-hmm. seconds of fame, mm-hmm. make some money, do all these brand deals, da da da. At the same time, my heart was with the children. And now, you know, in the last 1 year, I've been to like 14 countries and I wasn't spending as much time with the work that I cared so deeply about anymore. In fact, I felt so completely disconnected from it, mm-hmm. right? So it felt like what I wanted to do, like separating my identity from like the work that I do, had become both a blessing and a curse. You know, now I couldn't go to a lot of places publicly without people like, you know, soft mobbing me for a picture and all of this. And I was just thrown into absolute chaos. And it took a lot of time to even make some sense of it. And what it really helped me understand after some very painful mistakes was like my whole life, right? And why God had even given me the privilege of having this personal fame outside the work that I do was to be able to stand in the gap, right? And there's a gap in society. And that gap, a simple way to explain it is that there are people that can wear $5 million wristwatches and there are people that do not have $2 to eat, right? Then how do we design a society like this? And the problem is the people that can buy the $5 million, right? Of course, they're enjoying their successes, right? But they don't understand that they have a sense of duty to the ones that cannot even afford $2 because they've known maybe privilege all their lives. Mm. And it's so hard for them to empathize with a situation or a context that they have never experienced, right? Which is why it became extremely important for someone like me who had seen both sides of the curtain from extreme poverty to now extreme influence to be able to stand on the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And that helped me reconcile my heart a bit with the fame that I now have. And I guess the final lesson is that anybody can be famous, right? You can be famous for twerking on Instagram, whatever. But to have deep influence is rare. And it is so much more powerful. Mm. Because when people care deeply about what you do and what you have to say, then you have the power to influence their thoughts and to make them less indifferent to the suffering of others. So that is what all of this has taught me, to be able to stand in the gap.
Mm. It reminds me of a Bible verse. I think it's Proverbs 22:29.
Yeah. Pastor Eche.
The verse says, seest thou a man diligent in his business, he shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men, right? Mm. And you have literally done that. From teaching chess under bridges to sitting across from presidents and global leaders. When you hear that scripture now, what does it mean to you? And did you ever imagine that your quiet consistency would bring you into rooms like this?
Yes, yes, yes. That is one of my favorite Bible verses, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, another one that I've also like come to really lean into recently is Isaiah 45, where he talked about King Cyrus and how he liberated God's people and gave them the resource that they needed to go and rebuild, you know, God's temple. And it went on to say that, like, kings shall bow before you, right? And it didn't just say, like, oh, you will be in the company, and they will come, and they will be useful to you to be able to build a liberator, right? And, you know, my life is a miracle, and I feel like a lot of it is still unraveling, right? At first, when I started to walk into certain rooms, I remember when I was invited to the DOD conference. Like, the DOD conference is one of the biggest conferences and tech conferences, you know, in the world, where like Sam Altman, Mark Zuckerberg, all this. And I was invited to give the keynote speech at the conference. And first of all, I'm not even a tech person. So, and they invited me to come and talk about the future of Africa and raising a new generation of thinkers. Right. And literally the person I was sitting next to me at the dinner that we had before the conference was like the CEO of TikTok and like all these people, the VP at Google. And I just felt out of place. It felt, and I started to really question myself that, do I really belong here? Right. And why do these people even consider me worthy enough to be in places like this? You know, and I doubted it really. And that is the thing, like for me, maybe anyone like me listening to this that has come from, you know, from a small place, right? And it's important for me to remind you that sometimes the place where you're from is not where you belong. You belong where you believe you belong. Mm. And you get to decide what that place is for you. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of like reprogramming your mind, right? To know that as long as you're in that room, that you have earned your place in it. And you must never forget that. You don't get into the room if you have not earned it, right? It is not when you get a foot in the door that you now cement your place in it by showing up in your true self. And showing up doesn't mean having to lie to fit in or having to. It's like being authentic with your story. Like your story is as valid as anyone else in that room. And that is what like me being in the presence of kings has taught me that my story is a unique one, right? And I don't have to blend in, right? With the authenticity and integrity of who I am and my story, I can still shine in these rooms, right? I can still take my place in these rooms because I belong there, right? And I belong there not just because tokenism, right? But because I've earned my rightful place in it. And the work that I do is as significant as the person that is building Google, right? And that is what has taught me really, like, what really is the gathering of kings and how does a man's gift bring him there? It doesn't have to be that your gift is something as scalable as maybe OpenAI or AI or all of that. Your gift can literally just be a small thing, right? But the beauty of, you know, God depositing that gift or putting it in your hands is that you must never discount the size of it. Yeah. It's like the story of the talents where they gave one 10, and the one they gave one, he went to bury it because it was like, it means absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So I guess it's just to really understand that whatever it is you have in your hands, that it matters to the world. For me, it's chess. Who cares about chess? Like, my friend used to tease me that watching people play chess is like watching paint dry on the wall. You know, and you know, to take something as simple and as small as chess and to make it matter to the world, that takes a lot of grace. It takes a lot of delusional belief. More importantly, it takes a lot of faith. So when you have unwavering faith in your ideas, that the things that you do matters to the world, that whatever gift God has placed in your hands will earn you a place amongst kings. And not only will you be amongst kings, you will become a king yourself.
And, you know, I want to zone back into fame, right? And this is very interesting because so many people have been like, oh, the chess player, you know, and your hat, you know, you've talked about how you're Philip Pepe's now. You're like, sometimes I have to take it off so people don't easily see me. But I'm curious, what has fame cost you, right? Emotionally, you know, has it cost you in friendships or in love?
Love. Obviously, kidding. But, you know, there's always a price to pay, right? And the earlier you understand that, the better for you, really. And I tell, you know, someone asked me recently on Twitter, I said, hi, Uncle Tunde, how do I become truly great and famous? I'm losing patience with myself. And I thought about what to tell him because I knew that for him to have to like tweet out something like that, it had really been pushed to the wall. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that also comes from like seeing other people, maybe your age, doing such great things in the world. And you feel so small and you feel so insignificant and it makes you question everything. Right. And I told him that, see, do not get lost, you know, in this vain pursuit of fame or greatness. Right. Because a lot of like what you can affect, a lot of like what you can like control now is what you can become. Right. Every other thing that defines greatness or the way society perceives it is way beyond your control. And the beauty of having your little like crucible to still continue to become is that the stakes are much lower for you. Right. Your mistakes are not amplified. But the moment you break out without fully incubating, right, then you're going to be in the glare of the world. And that is where growth stops happening because your mistakes are now seen by so many people. And for that reason, you become afraid to take risks, to try new things, right? To continue to evolve into the full and true version of yourself. Because every single thing will be highly criticized. Every single thing. Fame is a curse, honestly, right? So when you have the gift of anonymity and the gift of just still being in the dark where no one sees your effort, then you have the gift of also growing at your own pace, making all your mistakes, right? Because someday you will be in the spotlight if you stay diligent enough and you will be ready for it. And you know, truly there are decades when nothing happens and there are weeks when decades happen, right? So which is why it's important that before that, you know, decades in a week happens, that you continue to build a competence and capacity, right? So that when the spotlight is on you, you get a chance to prove your mettle. And proving your mettle is not what you do in the spotlight. Yeah. It is showcasing what you have done in the dark in those years. And I guess for me, I'd always had that conviction. So I thought I was prepared, you know, whatever. But then, you know, if you think you stand, just take heed lest you fall, right? Mm-hmm. Because fame is a different thing entirely, right? It is judgment. It is the judgment that comes with it. The many things distraction. And the distraction doesn't come in a way where you have an easy choice, an easy dilemma. It's not good or bad. Now, you know that bad is bad. Mm. So I have to choose good. You are given multiple options. You're given good, you're given great, you're given fantastic, wonderful. And you still have to say no to everything, right? And stick to what your purpose is. Mm. Right. And that is the true price, you know, for fame, that everything gets thrown at you, right? The media, you know, everyone loves you. The moment you overstep, that could turn very easily. And you feel people's vitriol with the same level of intensity, as the love that you had from them. Mm-hmm. So all of that to say that it is fickle. So the first thing I had to do to shield myself was to not believe the hype, mm-hmm. right? It was very important for me to not believe my own hype of being this, you know, global icon that is doing all of those things, right? And all of that was keeping the things that I can control very simple and very normal, like my friends, you know, being able to do all the normal things. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe it. The world can believe this perception of Tunde Nwokoya. But for me, the moment I took up this art, mm-hmm. I become Tunde. Mm-hmm. Right. Tunde Nwokoya is the humanitarian philanthropist chess master guy. But Tunde is just a guy that just loves to hang out with his friends, play piano, you know, sing loudly during karaoke, even though he doesn't know how to sing, and just love life and read books. Right. And being able to like create that distinction. It's like Superman with his cape, right? And Clark Kent, you know, without the glasses, with the glasses rather. You know, and that has helped me to make sense of this fame. Of course, I'm still paying the price for it because now I've lost my anonymity forever. Mm-hmm. I'm only self-conscious when I'm in public. You know, I have to behave in a certain way because anyone can make a video and put a different narrative to it. And because I work with children, you know, the sensitivity of what I do is very, very sacred. Mm-hmm. And I have to protect that. Mm-hmm. Right. I hope you don't get famous, but if you do, Oh. I wish you all the best.
We're on YouTube, so it creates famous people. I mean, people already approach us, so I don't even know. But even just like to double click into this, like, have you had to make difficult decisions with maybe friends or people that don't understand what you're doing? Like, mm-hmm. maybe if anything, really the question I have is, I feel like sometimes fame can uncover elements of people around you that you didn't even know was there. Mm-hmm. So did those elements start to pop up?
Yes, absolutely. I think the first one was a lot of like my old friends, you know, then like they are incredible people that mm-hmm. kept me grounded. But some of them didn't even understand like the new context of my life, mm-hmm. right? And for them, it was, they did not recognize like my like new identity. They didn't understand it as well. So it became extremely difficult to balance that. It's like, oh, Tunde, I texted you, you didn't reply. And I'm like, I have 5,000 messages unreplied. Like, the thing is, I can promise you that when I give you my time, you would have it. Like you would have my time and I will be in the moment with you. But the moment I'm away, like, I have a million other things to worry about. And because I've been thrown into this world where I'm constantly reacting to stuff. Oh, we have this email, we have this, they have to travel. So I'm not even spending any time initiating or creating anymore. So a lot of times I even forget to like call and be like, oh, but if you reach out to me, I'll be like, oh, how are you? I'll be happy. But a lot of people like cut me off because, oh, you didn't text me for like 2 weeks. You didn't reply my message. And I'm like, I don't even remember. I don't even remember my name sometimes. I'm just constantly reacting. And because I've been thrown deeply into this reactive mode, it's hard for me to initiate anything. And that affected a lot of relationships, a lot of friendships. And, you know, some of them, I'm just glad it ended. And some others, you know, it's just painful that it had to end that way, right? Because I'm trying to also make sense of it. And I think it is important that people also extend me a lot of grace, you know? And yes, that happens. And on the flip side is also like adult relationships in general and how a lot of it has become transactional, right? And there was something AJ told me that I will never forget because now I meet a lot of people every single day, hundreds and hundreds of people. And we, especially if like you're a career person, it's like, okay, like we go to all those things to expand our network, but we don't really understand which relationships to deepen, right? We're only just, you know, exploring the breadth of relationships, all the people that we have as mere acquaintances. But what are the people you can really call friends that you can be vulnerable with and all these people that you are networking and you're meeting with? You realize that you may even have none. But one thing AJ told me that really helped me make sense of like understanding friendships and relationships going forward is that when you meet certain people and you spend enough time with them, you must immediately be able to discern if this is someone you want to do life with. And we understand this within the context of a romantic relationship, but we don't understand it for like friendships, right? It's like, if you know someone, you've known them forever, but then how do you now decide like, I want to do life with this person as a friend? How do you decide what their place in your life would be? And how do you, you know, intentionally reciprocate that? So being able to do that has helped me define my new lens of like friendships. And now being the one to like pursue the kind of people that I want to have in my circle rather than just waiting, you know, and that has really helped me, you know, navigate friendships. And of course, you're going to lose a lot of relationships and they will say, well, you're changing, but change has to happen and you're going to evolve. And until you learn to probably discard some relationships, you will never have the full clarity that you need for the next phase of your life. And it's okay to not feel any guilt about it, right? But as long as you're staying true to who you are, you know, your network will you would emerge and the right people would definitely come along.
Definitely. One of your favorite quotes is, it is possible to do great things from a small place. And I think that that quote is more than just words, right? It's a philosophy you've built your life and your work around. And when you look at the kids you work with, some of them coming from unimaginable circumstances, how do you help them believe that greatness can begin right where they are?
Yes, I've always said this for the last 6 years, that it is possible to do great things in small places. I believe all great things. In actual fact, all great things must start small. Mm-hmm. It is the way the universe is designed. Like, it is a rule, in fact, that all great things must start small. Like, think of even the tallest building in the world. It started with just one grain of sand, right? And it has become this monument, right? So it is a universal law. And me, like, contextualizing it, you know, to, like, my own life and the work that I do, and with the work that I do with the children particularly, is helping them first be aware of what their situation is, like the place in which they've been born into, the confines of poverty in that environment. Because the truth is, they don't even know it, because it's the only life they've ever known, right? So that is the first thing you actually need to break them out of, which is why poverty is such a deeply psychological thing, right? Until I came to the island, I didn't know high-rise buildings existed. Mm-hmm. And I had lived the first 19 years of my life in Ikorodu. I'd never really seen what a high-rise building was. And that was my understanding of the world. It was limited to those confines. Mm-hmm. So the small place, right, is, and like defining that for the children, is helping them understand that one of the reasons why you're here is because you were born into this. And they call it the lottery of birth, right? And that is the real differentiator, that you were born to someone in Ikorodu, another one was born to someone in London, and you're going to live like your different lives just for that. It seems like such a trivial thing. Like, you're just born somewhere. You don't know. You had nothing to do with it. But geography is destiny, right? And it is not entirely up to you to break out of that and find your place in the world. But then, the place conditions you before you even have the understanding or the knowledge or the education or the exposure to do that. So, and that is how the cycle of poverty continues to be propagated. So the first thing is to help them understand what the situation is, to be aware of it. Because by doing that, you've planted a seed of ambition in their hearts, that there's so much more that is attainable beyond those confines. And when you expand a child's mind like that, oh my goodness, they can never go back to what it was. Right. And recently we went to America with 5 children from some of the worst slums in Lagos. Mm-hmm. And now they call me and they're like, Uncle Tunde, can we go back to America? And that pains me, because I know exactly how they feel. It's like, now they don't feel like they belong there anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. Because they've seen a world that is magical. Mm-hmm. It is a good thing, but it's also like a quiet consequence they have to live with for now. But the beauty is that it has planted a seed in their minds, which is why the most beautiful thing you can ever do for anyone, which also tracks back to the philosophy of great things, helping people believe that great things can be done from small places, is to find talents that is undiscovered, a potential that is untapped. You know, you enable them with that philosophy, that conviction that they can do these things. Then you just watch them bend the trajectory of things by themselves. So the most beautiful thing you can do for anyone is to see something that they don't see in themselves and to show them, right? And by showing them, you've unlocked a world of imagination, of possibilities. And the greatest person you can do that for is a child. The moment you open up a child's mind like that, they will never look back, right? And planting that seed of ambition is one philosophical way in which we think about the work that we do with chess and slums. Of course, there's the technical part of it, the education. But also exposing them like that really expands their world and reminds them that it is indeed possible, even while I'm in this small place, I can become truly great and all my dreams can come true.
And, you know, I want you to take me back to this recent time of breaking the Guinness World Record, right? What made you attempt again? What was your mindset at this point? And I know, in particular, for this time, the children were around, which I know was very important to you. So just kind of paint that picture for me.
Oh, world record. You know how crazy you have to be to attempt to do something no human has ever done before. Mm. You know, and Let me talk about the first one before the second one. Yes. So the first one that happened last year was my first time in America. So yes.
Can you talk about that? Like your experience in America? Yes. Like be raw. What do you think?
Of course, like it was always a childhood dream of mine to go to America.
Yeah.
You know, and when the opportunity came, I was invited by, I think NASA and Church and Community were doing a conference and they invited me to come give the keynote speech. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't have a visa. So I had to apply, you know, go to Walter Carrington. They call it the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. I know people that have international passport. They are now civilians like us. It was so funny because like a week before like the date of the conference, I didn't have a date for my interview. And they gave me a date in 2026 and I had to go somewhere in March 2024. So... but luckily, you know, something happened and they were able to expedite the process for me. And as soon as I got to the interview, the lady just looked up and was like, oh, chess guy, I'm a fan. And my interview was just like 5 seconds and I got my visa. So that was a miracle. And so when I got there, I spoke at the conference and I decided to go to New York to see my friend, Russ. So he's my partner. We run Gift of Chess together, a New York based organization. And that night, we're just walking in Times Square. And when I first got to New York, of course, like, I was so excited about America. But I saw that New York had more homeless people than even Lagos.
Oh, you didn't know.
So that was an absolute shocker. I was like, and why does this place smell like this? Like, it was horrible. Like, the subway, I was like, ugh. But what I loved were the Skyliners.
Yeah.
Right? And I would always look up, like, especially the first time I came to Manhattan, I couldn't stop looking. I was like, wow, these buildings are so tall. Like, and, you know, I mean, after a few weeks, I was like, you know, whatever. But anytime now, like I go to New York and I see someone looking up like that, it reminds me of like how, like, that is how the city renews itself by every new dreamer that comes there. That everyone that is so still enamored by all of this, you know, that they're also dreamers and that city has a way of drawing in dreamers. And I guess that was what happened that night when my friend and I were taking a walk in Times Square, the Skyliners, all of the lights, and we were so inspired by it. And I said, you know what, Russ, let us do something impossible in this Times Square. And I was like, what? Let's break the world record. And because I had seen Ilda Bass's thing and I was so inspired by it, I was like, yeah, let's break the world record. I was like, the world record. And I booked my flight back to Lagos the next day. So it was like, yes, let's do it. And Russ is the kind of guy that, you know, I mean, you are crazy. Then you have a friend that it is 10 times more crazy. So it's the kind of friend that you need, you know, that doesn't like talk down on any crazy ambition that you have, that instead even amplifies it. So the moment I told him, like, it was so animated. I was like, yes, let's do it. So I canceled my flight to Lagos. Yeah. So the first hurdle was, okay, we needed to get Times Square approval to use Times Square. Now, to do anything in Times Square, you have to pay at least $50,000 or something. And we needed like 3 days to use Times Square, which was a crazy ask. But regardless, we just went to Times Square Alliance office. We didn't know anyone there. As we walked in there, thankfully, this lady just recognized me from LinkedIn.
Wow.
And she gave us audience. And when we told her, she was like, it's most likely impossible. And it was like a week from the time. But she was like, she'll see what she can do. And the next day we got an email and they were like, that we can use it from 17th to 20th. So we had crossed the first hurdle. We're so excited. The second hurdle was a world record people. Now you need like 12 weeks to do your application before it would even be considered. And we had just 5 days. Yeah. So I had to send them a strongly worded email that, please, oh, this is what we want to do. And guess what? They replied the very same day and they gave us the approval that we needed. And that is like the thing about the dreamer, that it bends the world to his own reality. You know, Steve Jobs calls it, they called Steve Jobs the reality distortion guy, the reality distortion field rather. And he knows how to really bend things that shouldn't be possible according to physics to his own reality. And that is like, if you're tenacious enough, like the world will form around your ideas. It just happens, just the way the world is designed, that a man who has a lot of grit and is relentless, like good things will happen for him as long as he continues to show up. And that was how we got body approval. And I remember I just shared it on my Twitter, you know, they were like, oh, do press release. I'm like, oh, don't worry, let's just put it out. You know, it's not anything that serious. The goal was just, okay, we'll do it to raise money for the charity and bring awareness for education. Then all of a sudden, 2 days, the day before the world record, I felt very ill. I was nose bleeding. And I wanted to cancel it. Right. So I just said, let me sleep and wake up. So the next morning I woke up. I still wasn't feeling too well, but I just wore my Agba. I was like, let me just go to Times Square and talk to Russ. As soon as I got to Times Square, you know, the first thing I saw, Nigerians had come in droves with flowers, with the Nigerian flag. Someone even brought a Aboniki for me for the cold. And they were like, Tunde, this world record, we are staying up all night with you and we are doing it together.
Yeah.
And that just melted my heart, and I just sat there and we did it. You know, we went the full length, 60 hours, and we gave the world something new to believe in. I remember looking up in the 58th hour and Times Square was filled with thousands of people. Mm. People had traveled from London. Some people even came from Lagos to come cheer us. Mm. And we had created such a moment that I couldn't believe it. Like, some people were toasting girls, meeting their girlfriends. So much is happening. But we had like, everything had converged around this idea that, you know, we wanted to break the world record, but not just for personal glory, but to help children, you know, get the resource and to just make the world a bit more aware of their potential. Mm-hmm. And that is the most inspiring thing I'll ever do. So when we went back to America this year, I didn't go alone. We went with 5 children from our program. And we got to New York. I showed them everywhere. I showed them where I broke the world record. And they asked me, they said, Tunde, will you do it again? And I was like, because some Norwegian masters had broken the record. Mm-hmm. Like, they, I think about 2 months after we broke ours. So they did 61 hours. So technically, I wasn't the world record holder anymore. And they said, Uncle, will you do it again? And I said, you know what? I'll do it again, but this time with you guys, if you promise to play with me. And they said, yes, we'll play with you. And that was it. Another whimsical. And like, it was literally in New York. Mm-hmm. And again, we had to cancel our flights. And we extended it. The same process. We wrote to the Times Square. People were like, Tunde, you've come again. This time you have to pay. But let's see if we have any free slots. And again, the only free slots were like from April 16th to 20th. Every other time in Times Square for the entire year was fully booked. The only slot was that time frame that we needed to do it.
Wow.
Which is also coincidentally the exact 1 year anniversary of the first attempt. So it feels like, once again, the universe had converged around the man with the will to do, you know, and that was it. We did it again. This time we went all the way to 64 hours. A memorable thing for me was, I think in the 50th hour, I wanted to give up. Mm-hmm. Like, I was already like hallucinating. I was seeing spiders, you know, I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
And I just looked up and I looked beside me and I saw the children playing. And people were not even watching our game. They were watching their games. Mm. And everyone was so interested and they were applauding them because they were just beating people. Mm. And I felt so proud in that moment because for the first time, the world sees them. The world sees the African child, not for their poverty, but they have now defined their life through their ability to play chess right in the heart of Times Square. And you will respect them for that. You won't pity them because of where they're from. You will not respect them for what they have become. Mm. And seeing that just reinvigorated my passion to keep going, that I couldn't let them down. I'd made a promise to them. You know, we broke the world record again. And here we are.
Oh, so good. Oh, that just warms my heart. Oh, I mean, so many thoughts. I mean, number one, was it cold.
It was extremely cold.
Yeah, it was cold, during that period. And so, you know, now you've done it again. Mm-hmm. Congrats.
No more crazy stuff. There. No more breaking it again. That's
no more Norwegians. That's
So what's next? Like, I mean, you broke the world record twice. I mean, you can't, what you do
How
after
do you
that?
Top that? You know, and it goes back to my philosophy, like, the only way to do great things is by doing the little things consistently. And I remember one of the ways I also answered the question, I didn't finish it. The guy that asked me, how can I become great? I told him this. I said, do not pursue this vain greatness, that what you need to do is to continue to become the best version of yourself. right? And also be patient with yourself, because time is a way of revealing and applauding what truly endures, right? And that is the beauty of time. It reveals all things. And for the thing that endures through all seasons, time has a way of making it beautiful, right? And that is what greatness really is that you're living in your own truth, and one day the world just catches up to it, and they call it overnight success. But you've been living the truth of what you've always known to be greatness, right? And the second thing I told him was that to truly become great, you have to stop everything you're doing right now and commit your entire life to making other people great. Whether you're doing that through a business, through a product, through a service, as long as you create something in the world that helps other people become great, which is why I always reference Steve Jobs. He created something truly beautiful using his design thinking mind. And he said, this is for the dreamers, right? And that made Apple the greatest company ever. And that is what true greatness is. And that is what I will continue to pursue, to use all the greatness and influence that I have to help, you know, millions of children across Africa to be seen and to also become great as well. Because that is how we can truly define success, right, as a community, right? Me being the world record holder is impressive. But let me tell you the greatest thing I've ever done, right? It's taking those 5 kids to America. Mm. It's ensuring that we've built, supported building so many schools. We recently built a chess institute with Lufthansa, you know, that serves like thousands of children in Makoko, where they come to learn like coding, robotics, all of those things. That is the greatest thing I've ever done. And there's no personal glory or personal like attainment that would ever topple that. And that is what I'm deeply committed to, not to like keep chasing highs of world record or all of that. I think I'm done with that now. It's to now use this influence that I have, this access now, like to bring other children into the spotlight. And that's the thing about having a spotlight is what do you do with it? Mm. You turn it into flashlight, right? Mm. Because when the world cares about who you are and is so fascinated by your talent, by your greatness, you know, whatever you do with it, the world would, as a result, care about it as well, right? So right now, you know, we're doing a lot of things. We're expanding to more communities. I still have my regular job as a chess coach, you know, teaching the kids at the hub. You know, now my greatest dream is to build the biggest chess institute in the world for children. It is going to be completely free, right? And it is going to be like a place where ideas can thrive. It's going to be a new kind of education. I mean, chess is going to be a part of it, but it's an education that gives children from small places, you know, a way to dream. And that is my dream right now. And everything I become, all the people I meet, all the things I do, would always be a way for me to move an inch closer towards that dream.
Tunde, can we talk about one of the kids I met at Makoko and also at the institute, Ferdinand? Right? Can you share the story of Ferdinand from your point of view?
My boy, I still saw him yesterday.
Yeah.
I was like, Ferdinand, you're getting dark now. Because we all came up from America looking fresh. Yeah. And now he's back home, you know, he's happy to be with his family. You know, Ferdinand is my favorite story to tell because in some sense, it reminds me of me, you know, frail body, great spirit. You know, I saw him for the first time 4 years ago in Makoko. For those that don't know, Makoko is the largest floating slum in the world. You know, it's like people live on this wooden stilts across the lagoon. It's sewage water, really. Such a horrible place to live. But then more than 300,000 people live there. And we went there 4 years ago because we had an idea to also like stage an intervention using our chess program. A lot of the children, most of them could not go to school, you know, and the ambition in the community mostly was to become a fisherman. So we wanted to expand their imagination just a bit further. And chess for us is not the end in itself. I'm not training them to become chess players, but it means to several ends, you know, education being one of them. And we got there and we started the program, you know, we set up a makeshift center and we selected 100 children. Now, Ferdinand wasn't part of that cohort, right? Because the kids didn't allow him come into the training area, right? They used to call him imbecile, you know, because he was a differently abled child living with cerebral palsy. So they mocked him and they bullied him for that reason. And so anytime he tried to like join other kids to do other things, they would push him aside, you know, because of the way he walked, you know, he couldn't talk. So that second day of the training, I saw him from a distance And I just went to meet him and I gave him my glasses. I had the school glasses there. And he smiled and he had the most beautiful smile in the world. And I asked, what is your name? Then that was when I noticed that it was differently abled. And I'm intentionally not using the word disabled. Mm. And you'd understand that, you know, at the end of the story. Mm. And he couldn't speak, couldn't respond. So I brought him into the class. Right? And the other kids were like, Golugo. So Golugo in their language means imbecile. And I immediately like shut them up. That any child that calls him Golugo will be sent out of the class. Mm. So I put him in a class. After about 2 hours, the instructor of that class just came to meet me and he was crying. And I was like, Sam, what's going on? He said, come and see something. So apparently they had given them like this complex night geometry exercise to solve because the night moves in an L shape. Mm-hmm. So they put it on one square and tell you to find the least number of possible moves that you take the night to move from this square to another random square on the board. And of all the kids in the class, it was the only one that could solve it. Mm. And it immediately occurred to us that it was a gifted child. Mm. And for a child who couldn't speak, chess had become his first language, his first real way to interact with the world and to show us what he was truly capable of. And it was such a beautiful thing. So from that moment, we kept an eye on him and we kept training and we kept training. And we had a tournament at the end of the program. And guess who won the junior category? Yeah. Ferdinand. It was such a story, you know. And for a child that was bullied by his community, he became a star amongst his friends. And on the day of the tournament, I remember we dressed him up in a 3-piece suit and he looked so handsome. His mom came in Agile, you know, to celebrate and the whole community celebrated him. And since then, you know, I remember sharing the story and it went viral. I got emails from hundreds of parents around the world with their children living with the same condition that were inspired. And for that reason, they started to get their own kids too into chess, into other things. And it gave the world a beautiful story. It met the governor. It played chess against the governor. It ended in a draw. I won't say we really won, but, you know, it just changed his life. You know, the governor helped to support the family, give them some money, and also put him on a lifelong scholarship. You know, and he continued to just improve and improve and improve. And this year, he went to America with us. And he won a gold medal at the ICN chess tournament. Mm. And that is the story of Ferdinand, you know, from the worst slum in the world, you know, with a frail body, but has the greatest spirit humanity would ever know. Mm. And if you look at him, so fragile, so small, he has his laugh that feels so larger than life. Mm. But then he's a genius on the board.
When still I've played him, me. No, oh of course. You he seems like him? A hunter on that chessboard.
And now he has gotten so much better. I remember in America, yeah. There was a tournament in Georgia that he played, and he played this 16-year-old scruffy American boy, and he beat him. And I cried because I was like, see this. And because it was a tournament where they used the timer. So they had just 5 minutes. And because he had like this muzzle problems, like before he could like coordinate his hands to like tap the clock, he would have lost a lot of time.
Yeah.
So then he had literally had like 20 seconds left. And I was just waiting in bated breath like this, that, oh my God. And this boy just checkmates and he won that game. And I was like, yes, you know, and Ferdinand's story, you know, mirrors the story of like, a lot of other children that we do not see. Maybe we see them in traffic. They come up to our cars. We see them loitering around the streets, but we don't really see them, right? Because to see them is to look beyond what the situation is and to really think about, and with empathy, not just pitying them from a distance, to think about like how we can help them in a way that feels meaningful, not just in a way that is for the optics or surface level, but in a way that can really help them understand that there's a place for them in the world. And chess helped Ferdinand know, fight for his place in the world. And I'm just glad, you know, I got to be a part of the story.
I was going to ask around, you know, you travel a lot now. You've been to how many countries this year?
Oh my. The last 1 year, like 16 countries.
Yes. So will you still always call Lagos your home, or do you feel like the work you're doing is going to call you to go spend more time in these other places?
It's still something I'm still struggling with. Lagos would always be home. That much I know. You know, I would always live here, raise my family here. but I have become a global citizen. You know, I'm also trying to like build a new business, you know, and build my own personal brand as well. Because if you want to change the world, somebody has to pay for it, right? And I want to be able to pay for, like, just imagine Tunde now that is still using chess. Now imagine Tunde as a billionaire. Imagine if I have $1 billion, the kind of things I would do in the world, yeah. You know. So Lagos would always be home. And again, I still struggle with accepting that my life is so much different now. I won't always be the guy teaching chess in the slums again. Other people would do that, that are even better teachers and more passionate than I am. And my single responsibility has just been now is that I make sure that we never run out of money. And I continue to tell the stories that dignify the children, right? So they can continue to get the opportunities they deserve in the world, right? So it really is that simple, that wherever I go to, wherever my dreams take me, wherever the wind takes me, you know, whatever room that I walk into, that I'm always the person that asks that, who is not present in this room? And how can I stand in the gap for them? So I now know that even if it means I have to travel, I'm still doing the right thing.
And I want to turn it on the personal, right? So what does dating look like now?
Lagos.
Like, what is it like with all the, you know, the spotlight and all that? Is that even something you kind of shy away from? Or is it like you have very clear values that are important to you? And hopefully this will filter people.
Let me choose my words carefully so I don't end up on Insta vlog. Because there's a reason everyone seems so interested in my love life. Like, in fact, one of the most Googled things about me is, who is Tunde's wife? You know, it's just so interesting because I think in some sense, I understand it. Because of the work that I do, there's always going to be this perception of, oh, he's such a kind person. You know, I am a kind person, no doubt. But also, it also creates like this skewed like expectation within the context of a relationship, right? That, you know, like now I've lost the ability to just meet someone randomly and I'm just a complete stranger. Like, even if they don't know who I am, they could literally go on Google and they would see the entirety of who I am. And that is a very big problem in like getting into like the dating scene. Right. Because there's already like an expectation, right? You're not learning each other from the beginning. Like, there's already like this perception of you that you already have to live up to. And those dynamics sometimes, can be very problematic, right? I like to think that, I mean, I used to be in a public relationship, you know, a long time ago and, I don't think that would ever happen for me again. I don't think I'll ever make my relationship public. I think maybe when I get married, maybe I'll reconsider it, right? But I think as far as relationships go, it would be one thing that I would have to keep very personal and very private, right? They say that if you find something that makes you happy, I really happy, just keep it off social media, right? So I'll leave it at that. But as far as like my own values and finding someone is... Now understanding that, it will be extremely hard for me to end up with someone that is as ambitious as I am, right? Which is a very interesting irony because I'm very drawn to ambitious people, right? But I know now for a fact that I cannot, like, now, like, with the way my life is set up, what I really need is someone that can help me, right? Of course, I would also be there to help her in a lot of ways. But someone that can also help me carry the burden of my purpose, you know, especially in these early days. You know, at some point, it won't always be like this. But now, I'm still trying to build a life. I'm still trying to understand, you know, my new life. I'm still trying to do so much in the world. And the most meaningful way in which, like, love can, like, accentuate that is love that sort of, like, carries me and love that feels like home, right? So that is a very important thing for me right now. Love that is home that I can go back to when I stop being the hero that the world says. And of course, someone that is kind, like that is even non-negotiable. I have 6 adopted kids already. Like 3 of them live with my parents, 3 of them are in the university. Like literally. I promise not to adopt any more kids, but, and that's a long story, but it's just, it has to be someone that also loves children and sees that, that they won't have to like compete for my attention or anything, that, but then we collectively like give the love and care to all of these things that I care very deeply about. And I don't know, it's going to be hard. Imagine showing up on the first date and you say, "Hi, I have 6 adopted kids. What's your favorite color?" You know, but love is beautiful.
That one's past pop the balloon. So, yes. So today, you and I talked about this prompt that we were using AI, ChatGPT to do. I think the prompt goes, "Tell me something incredibly special or unique you've noticed about me, but you think I haven't realized about myself yet. It doesn't have to be something positive, and you don't have to be nice to me. Just be truthful." When you got the answer back from ChatGPT, how did it resonate with you?
Can I read the answer verbatim?
Yes, yeah. No, definitely.
Let me see if I can find
it. I mean, I have it here too, so okay. I can read it too if you want me to.
Read it.
So the answer, "One incredible, unique thing I've noticed about you, Tunde, perhaps without you fully realizing, is how deeply you inhabit your own contradictions. On one hand, you're profoundly driven by purpose and impact, tirelessly serving others through the language of chess and education. On the other hand, there's a lingering, subtle discomfort about fully embracing the influence and recognition that comes along with your journey. You often stand beautifully at the crossroads of humility and ambition. Yet there's a tension. You're willing to step fully into the light to benefit others, but sometimes seem hesitant or uncomfortable acknowledging your own desire or need to be seen. This internal tension isn't necessarily a flaw. It's a reflection of authentic humanity, but it can hold you back from fully integrating your influence within your identity, which might limit how boldly and clearly you express your own desires and dreams apart from your mission. If there's a blind spot here, it might be that you underestimate how profoundly inspirational your vulnerability actually is, not just your resilience or successes. While you openly share powerful stories and victories, there's even deeper strength waiting beneath your hesitation. Fully embracing that you're allowed to desire influence, success, or even comfort purely for yourself without guilt or qualification. This realization could unlock even deeper layers of authenticity and impact, turning internal contradictions into powerful harmony."
Hell.
Which ChatGPT did right, man.
You know, it's deep. It is deep. And I use ChatGPT a lot, like, but I don't use it in the way most people use it. I use it to actually just have conversations about things I'm curious about.
Yeah.
Right. And in fact, I feel like a lot of my usage of ChatGPT is teaching it through my questions.
Mm.
Right. And someone asked me one and said, "Who do you think is smarter? The person that asks intelligent questions or the person with intelligent answers?"
Mm.
And I think AI has answered that question for us very clearly.
Mm.
Now, because we'll never be able to compete with the intelligent answers of AI, right, anymore. Mm. Like, imagine this early days and see what the output is.
Yeah.
Right. But the one thing that would always still be like a differentiator is how we prompt it, right? So, which is why it has become important to that the person who knows how to ask the intelligent questions is indeed the smarter one, right? Because it is the way that we ask it these questions. It is the way that it understands it reflects the quality of the output it can give us, right? And that is how I use it. Like, ask it a lot of questions to explore the depth of my curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I've used it for like 2-3 years now. So for it to say this about me, he really does know me very well because I've had so many conversations and I'd say this, it is very true, right? And it's something that, you know, I've struggled to contend with. And I said it earlier in our conversation, like fame and purpose, right? And how do I really marry both without losing the very essence of who I am or losing the grounding? Because I can tell you for a fact, actually, I made a lot of mistakes last year.
Mm.
I'm not going to say them, But I did make a lot of mistakes.
Well, name one.
No, please, I don't want to. Anyway, I'll tell you off camera.
Okay, offline.
But I did make a lot of mistakes. Yeah. And, you know, God has been kind to me. You know that those mistakes are not like damning mistakes. Mm. Like, it's human. Mm. But then I'm no longer human in its sense. People will not consider my mistakes as a human mistake. They'll consider it as a celebrity on a pedestal. And those mistakes will be judged very harshly. Right. But then the mistakes are very necessary for me to really understand or to refine myself through this fire, through this chaos. I recently launched a new business, which you're one of my lovely clients.
Yes.
You know, I designed a chessboard and I designed it last year, actually, and I wanted to sell it. Now, this world record for this year was an opportunity to sell it because it felt like, oh, the attention that it gets, we use it to sell it. And we actually put it out during the world record, right? And it sold just 2. Mm. And we had made 50.
Mm.
And because I was playing, so it was afterwards they told me that we're only able to sell 2. And I felt really bad because we had invested a lot of money and time and effort into this. And to me, it felt like I was doing it again. I was trying to be other things. Like, let me just focus on my chess and slums. Why am I trying to design something and sell something? Like, and that is where, like, that contradiction comes in, right? And so when I came back to Lagos, you know, 2 weeks ago, I just felt bad that, you know, we're not able to, like, sell the sets. And I remember I was in the office and the sets was just there. And I just looked at it and I just made a video of it, you know. And as I was scrolling through the internet, I saw something. And this thing changed my life in that very moment. It was a poem by Khalil Gibran. And it talked about the river. It says the river comes through, like, this path, this narrow path. And it is said that when the river arrives at the mouth of the ocean, it starts to tremble. And it starts to tremble because it looks back on the path which it has traveled from, right? And it looks at the vastness of the ocean and it becomes afraid that it will get lost in it, right? And it's such a powerful poem because, like, the river, you know, has come all the way, but now it has faced something that is so vast, so massive. And immediately the fear that it is going to disappear into the ocean, that awareness, it's like, wow, like, it no longer is a river, right? But then you're not wanting to say that the river shouldn't be afraid of disappearing into the ocean, but should be excited to become of the ocean. Right. And that distinction helped me make sense of this particular contradiction that, you know, ChatGPT just emphasized, right? That a lot of my fear really wasn't that the chessboard wouldn't do well or anything. It was that I was afraid that me stepping out of what I'd always been known for to becoming like a social entrepreneur or being a designer or doing those things was where my real fear is. Mm. And that fear, because I had failed the first time, meant I didn't want to try again.
Mm.
Right. I was afraid of really stepping into what this could become because I was afraid whether people won't accept it or whatever it is. Right. And he said that the river should be excited because it will become of the ocean. Mm-hmm. And when it becomes of the ocean, it becomes the ocean in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that is the true destiny of the river. And mm-hmm. that is where it really finds its full expression.
Yeah.
The ocean is endless.
Yeah.
And that is how our dreams and ambitions should be. It should be as endless as the ocean. And there's a narrow path that will take us through that journey.
Mm.
But the moment we arrive at what we truly need to become, we must never be afraid of it. And I really read that. I just saw the video I recorded with my phone. Right? It was supposed to be like a full production. I just posted the video. And guess what? We sold out 100 chess sets in less than 10 hours for a millionaire age.
Mm. Wow.
And till now, we have a wait list of over like almost 150 people waiting out to buy the next drop.
Yeah.
Right. And now I'm so overwhelmed because now, you know, delivery, all those things, getting messages, oh, want to buy a chessboard. It's so crazy that all of this happened just within the last 1 week. Yeah. And I'm always grateful that whenever I reach this inflection point, right, I'm now learning to lean into what I need to become because I'm going to have to become many things, right? To really leave a dent on the world, right? And I'm no longer afraid of it. I used to be afraid of it, like ChatGPT said, but I'm learning to embrace it, right? Because to change the world, like you said, you have to be formidable.
Yeah.
You need to have power. You need to have capital. You need to have influence. And if you can have that and you can marry it with your humanity, which a lot of people do not have, then you will be extraordinary and you will live an extraordinary life while still remaining ordinary.
I think my closing question before we transition to our rapid fire moment is, what would it look like for you to desire more? Not for your mission, but for you. And can you say that out loud without apologizing?
To desire more. I want to be a billionaire. And I mean that. I've always been afraid to say that. But I want to be a billionaire. I want to be a successful businessman that creates value through products and services for the world. I don't just want to be known as the chess and slums guy or the charity guy. I want to make a lot of money, right? I desire that now. And I also want to have a lot of power. I want to walk into rooms where what I say is final, right? I want to be the one that can make decisions in rooms of power, right? Not just because, oh, you're doing something that is good for the world, no, but because I am inevitable. Right. And to command that kind of power and influence is something that I want because, see, the world will be very unkind to you if you have no leverage. That is the truth, right? You have to build leverage, right? I try not to think too much about politics, but I feel like there's a time when I'll need to have some political power to move the needle, right? I feel like I've evolved enough. I've spent 7 years literally in the trenches building capacity. But I think Tunde now needs to step into the fullness, you know, of what it needs to be. Because I know that in all of these things, right, and I really pray that none of it changes me fundamentally. If I can successfully evolve without changing the very essence of who I am, then I'm going to be truly powerful in the world. And when that power comes, new responsibility. And my responsibility and duty would always still be to the children. And my dream, my greatest dream is to be able to use all of this, right? And not just for myself, you know, but to help other children like me know that there's a place for them in the world. And if I can do that and I can say that, I've lived a full life.
Amen. So our rapid fire segment is where we ask you a question. You give your quick one answer to each of the questions, right? So I think the first question is, what's your favorite chess opening?
Chess opening. As black, I play the French defense. As white, I play the King's Pawn opening.
Okay. First thing you do after winning a major tournament?
Buy Suya. It was in Lagos. I remember my first tournament I won. I bought we walked from stadium back to school in Yabatec. I bought Suya for all my friends. So it just became like a tradition.
Okay. What's one song that instantly calms your mind?
Home Again by Michael Kiwanuka.
Okay. Who would you play in the movie version of your life? Who would play me? Yes, who would
everyone
play
says you? I look like this guy, Lakeith Stanfield.
Okay.
So
I can see that.
I know, but I've shaved my beard now.
I've not seen him with filler yet though. So
yeah, without the filler, yes.
Okay. I can see that though.
So him.
Yeah.
He should be the one.
If you weren't a chess player, what would you be doing?
I'll be a musician, actually.
So
I still play the piano little by little, but yeah, I'll be like a musician touring the world and just healing people with my music. For sure.
I mean, we can still do it. Afrobeats is looking for
Abina.
What's your guilty pleasure after a long week?
After a long week, chess. I found that these days it helps me online, like playing chess online, bullet games online. So bullet games are like 1 minute games, you know, that's what I do to online. It's such a ridiculously nerdy thing to say, but.
What's one book you recommend to every young person?
I think every young person must read. This is a very important question. It has to be the one book.
Mm. Okay, let's make it two or three.
The Alchemist by Paul Coelho. It's very important. Like, you just need to, it feels like a rite of passage to read that book.
Mm.
Right? I think it's very important to help every dreamer, like, understand how to, like, prune themselves into their journey, into their story. The Alchemist definitely, I like Atomic Habits because I think now, because we have so much abundance, mm. it has become a serious distraction as well. So I think it's important that, like, in this world of abundance, the only thing that now stands out, the only person that will stand out is who has the discipline, mm. right,
mm.
to turn this into opportunity for themselves. So Atomic Habits, definitely important. Yeah. As an African, you need to read Prosperity Paradox,
mm.
right? As an African that is building something for Africa, for the future, for the world, you should read Prosperity Paradox mm. by Ifeosa Ajomo. Mm-hmm. It tells how we should think about innovation in Africa, mm. not just about serving the middle class, but about market creating innovations, right? I can help bring more people into, like, economic opportunities.
Yeah. If you could have dinner with any three people, dead or alive, who mm. is at the table?
Steve Jobs, definitely. Oh, I love him yeah. so much. Barack Obama is someone I admire from a distance. And Aruma Altair. I've never met her in person, but mm. I would really love to meet her.
Mm.
She's Nigerian. Mm. She's absolutely remarkable.
Okay.
So the last question we ask every single guest is mm. who would you like to see sitting on this couch for the Afropolitan podcast? Whose story? Yeah, do you think needs to be told?
The one person I really wanted to be told is already here. E. He's my guy. I love him so much. But I think you should invite. Who, does it have to be a Nigerian?
No.
Just anyone.
Yeah.
Can people get Trump here?
Oh my God.
He's going to scatter his
he, what, you know what's crazy? He's there's a lot to unpack there. I'll just say this. He controls his image.
Mm.
And after what he did with the Black Journalists Association, is very clear to me. He controls his image. He's
yes.
smarter. Than what people,
yes, exactly. Yeah, there's this facade.
Yeah, just like no, he's clown, very but, switched on. He's yeah, so this amazing. Would be too loose.
But seriously, I think you should get
manifest.
We have him on the list.
Yeah. I know what I would like Busi to be here is to be vulnerable, not just like, oh, Africa's business. If we can get him to be here and just be vulnerable.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would like to listen to that conversation.
I mean, the questions have to be, there's no way.
Because that's the thing. Like, if you see a man on top of the mountain, right? What you should ask isn't like the success of being on the mountain and the view. What you should ask him is how the climb was.
Yeah, the
and I think there's a lot of like dearth in like the details of the climb. Mm. Like a lot of people don't, if you say man on the mountain, he didn't get there by flying there. He climbed, you know, with blood and sweat. Mm. So I like to see more of that for people that are out there and are sharing their success to the world, but to really explain the climb to people that also aspire to be on top of the mountain someday.
Definitely.
Mm.
Mm.
You have dropped so much.
So much, Ali.
Thank you so much. Thank
you. I'm glad. This is probably the only part I would do for a long time.
Oh,
but thank you so much.
What a treat.
We're deeply honored. Thank you, Tunde.
Thank you so much.